just talking through the pads on my feet. Never tasted water sweeter than from Cherry Creek. Mama gets home, it's off to the flume. Jump into the middle where the water's cool.
Well, welcome to this week's episode of For What It's Worth, called Music Man. I'm your host, Blake Melnick, and our guest this week is Tom Locke, who has just published a new book called Moments in Time, a musical odyssey which traces the history of rock and roll from the early 40s right through to the 70s. Tom, welcome to the show. So nice to have you on, and congratulations on the new book. It was absolutely fantastic. Thank you for providing me with an advanced copy. I loved it. Before we get into a discussion specific to the book, I wanted to get a bit of information about you. I know you live in Vancouver, but where were you born and where did you grow up?
First and foremost, thanks for interviewing me on this show. I'm very honored to be here. I was born and raised in Toronto and grew up in the suburbs of Willowdale, just north of the core. You probably know that area well.
I do.
Yeah, and then I did my kindergarten, public school, junior high, and high school, all in that area. Subsequently, I went to York University for 8 years and enjoyed my time there. And for those of growing up in that neighborhood, will probably remember Dominion Stores because I worked there as a clerk part-time to pay for my expenses through my school years.
Yeah, I haven't thought about Dominion in years. That's a great memory. You've had a fascinating and very diverse career. You've been in sports, film, business, coaching, and of course, music. What are some of the key tenets or beliefs that have guided you throughout your career?
That's a really great question. When I was putting together some courses for UBC, one specifically on creating your competitive edge, I had to reflect on this and came up with the acronym that it's truly my mantra, which is LAFF. That's L-A-F-F. The L stands for listen. The A stands for adapt. In today's vernacular, you might hear the word pivot.
Mm-hmm.
F is follow through. And the last F is fun with purpose.
With all of these experiences in your background, what's the best advice you were ever given in terms of your career and how you should approach life?
Well, that is actually an easy one because it was ingrained in me as a young kid growing up by my parents, particularly my mother. She said, if you say you're going to do something, do it, and do it to the best of your ability. And for me, it made so much sense, and I've tried to live by that. In fact, it's even morphed into something that I used to project in my classes. I called it the 5 P's. Proper planning prevents poor performance.
A sage piece of advice. One of the things I want to talk about before we get into the book is something I read that you'd written, and I can't remember whether I read it on your blog or was part of the intro to the book, but the pandemic has been really tough on us all, and the world has irrevocably changed, but you see the challenge of COVID as an opportunity. Tell me about that.
It truly was. COVID did become certainly a challenge for everyone, but behind every challenge, there is an opportunity. And the opportunity for me was a reduction in travel, more time at home, and times to move some things from the corner of my desk to the front of my desk. One of those is to write this book that I've been, I wouldn't say procrastinating on, but just haven't had the real time to put forward on it for, oh gosh, the past 5 to 6, 7 years. So this gave me a great opportunity to spend the time writing Moments in Time. I guess I got to thank COVID in some way for me to getting to that stage of actually producing this book.
Sometimes it does take a crisis moment or something that changes that we have no control over that actually forces us to change our behaviors and, as you say, to take on things that have been left at the side for some time. COVID created this moment in time where almost the entire world came to a complete stop. And people had a chance to slow down, to think, reflect on the things that were really important to them. And clearly, Moments in Time is something that was important to you.
I think one of the things that also pushed me a bit was I was getting a little grumpy, to be honest with you. And so were a lot of other people. So the great thing about music's always been an escape for me. And when I hear the songs that I grew up with, that I have some passion for, I can't help but have a smile on my face. And the whole idea was, hey, can I put some more smiles back on some people's faces? Because I think we all need it.
Yeah. I don't want to call it a distraction, but certainly people need other things to focus on rather than the news and COVID and how it's negatively affecting the world. There are some positive moments, and I think we all have to take some time to recognize that. You're clearly a huge music fan. So tell me about where that passion for music came from. I'm talking about at an early age. Somebody that writes a book like you've written is in love with music. How did that all begin for you?
I sort of joke about this a bit, that I was destined to be this, because on the day I was born, Music, Music, Music by Teresa Brewer was the number one record on the radio. And also my parents, they were quite young when I was born. And I probably grew up by osmosis listening to the songs through the 50s. And so became maybe a bit of an old soul when it came to that music, because it literally ingrained and became a part of me. And I guess the other thing is, living in what we often refer to in the media business, like Toronto, being a border town, in that we could get radio from south of the border from the U.S., I was transfixed in listening to stations out of Buffalo and Rochester areas where they were playing some music that wasn't on CHUM in Toronto. Like George the Hound Lorenz out of Buffalo, one of the early renegades or pioneers of rock and roll. And he played what he wanted to play, and he played the original music, the stuff that teenagers wanted to hear. And a lot of that was R&B.
I do remember that as well, growing up in Toronto. And for me, I was a young boy, and I couldn't go to sleep without having the radio on. So every night, from the time I can remember, I had the radio on at night. It was a ritual. I came in, I turned off my lights, I turned on the radio, and I think at that time Q107 had just started to emerge. FM radio was fairly new, and that's what led to my musical education, I think, or exposure. Were you a player? Do you play an instrument?
No, the only thing I play is the radio. I was in a group. We all had groups, especially after the Beatles came out. I'm like a 14-year-old kid. Everybody had to have a band. Because you didn't get a band, the girls would flock to you. And so our group wasn't that good. In fact, I used to refer to us as the Lackatones. And that we lost out to a one-armed violinist on the Ted Mack Amateur Hour. And then I ended up as a background singer for Marcel Marceau's choir. The only good thing I had going for me was my ears, because I could pick out a song that, hey, this is going to be a hit. That was my gift.
You've been chronicling the history of music for many years. Why do you think it's important to document the history of music and musicians? And what part do you think music plays in our world?
Well, in short, I got to believe that music is part of who you are. And its history is of, I think, great value to us in making sense of why we're here, if you will. That music component is a big piece. The other thing why I think it's so important, because it exercises what I like to refer to as theater of the mind. When you sit back and you conjure back in those days and certain songs, the memory you have will be different than the memory I have, but it also breeds part of your identity.
And music is so contextual. When you hear a song, it connects with a memory, usually a memory at the time that you first heard that song. It does seem to reinforce those old memories and people and situation and context. So I agree with you. In your recent interview with Vancouver's Ross Michael Pink, you talked about how the music industry has changed. He asked you that question. Do you think it's harder now for good music to be heard? It seemed easy when we were younger because we had the Billboard charts and DJs would go through those charts every week. And so you hear the new music, then you'd run out and you'd buy the 45. It seems more difficult now. Is it?
It's a great question. The way I look at it is, when I think of the music of the past, I not only visualize about the circumstance behind it, but I can see the record. I almost feel like I can touch it, whether it be an album or a 45. It's right in front of me. I think there's a good news, bad news situation. Because of social media, the marketplace, it has allowed people to put something on the net and see how it flies with everyone. The bad news is there's a lot of that stuff out there. Where do you go? There's still only 24 hours in the day to listen to it, and some may get dropped if there's not really a strategic promotional plan behind the song. And believe it or not, That is somewhat analogous to what happened in the 50s and 60s. I've uncovered so many phenomenal regional hits from different cities that just never made the charts despite being played on the air in that local city because there wasn't money promotion, there wasn't a strategic plan to break that record nationwide. I still think there's a similar problem for young and upcoming artists in the marketplace today.
Yeah, even though we've become more empowered, or musicians have become more empowered as a result of technology, in other words, they're able to get their music out on Spotify and iTunes and, in fact, self-publish. But there's so much. How do you get those really good songs that you might not have a chance to hear? One of the concerns I've always had about algorithm-based music is the algorithm does the work of the human being. So instead of going out on an exploration and learning about new music by going to the record store and pulling out a record and reading the liner notes and saying, boy, does that ever sound interesting? I think I'm going to buy this and see what it sounds like. Or going through those liner notes and of a record that you like and finding the musicians that play on that album, and then going out and purchasing their albums and expanding your repertoire that way. These days, it seems like the algorithm is doing it for you. So if you like a particular song, Spotify's algorithm, Apple's algorithm will go out and pull together a list of songs that all sound very similar. But I'm not sure that's a musical education.
No, and I'm not sure either. And also, I believe out of sight, out of mind. Let me make somewhat of a comparison. You go, I got to get a picture of this. You're taking a selfie, whatever it is, or you take a picture. You go home, you put it on your computer, you save it. But when do you ever go back and look at that again? Say, as opposed to a picture in an album, you flip up and say, oh, here's her, you know, history growing up as a kid. Because that book is there, and the odd time you'll go over and pick it out. So this out of sight, out of mind aspect. So relate that to music. You go in, you pull out an album cover, like you say, there's the liner notes. You read off the liner notes. Oh, yeah, that brought it all back. I challenge you whether you would go on your website under your music category where you've got things filed away, click on that and click on the liner notes you downloaded.
And that is the thing. I'm listening to new music at somebody else's house and there's a song playing and I go, wow, that's a great song. Who did that song? Who wrote that song? And people look at you with a blank stare because they really don't know. And it's because the algorithm has just put together a list, but they haven't had the time or the inclination to actually look at the songs and then do that background research on the artist. I also think that there's a selection process that happens. So if you like a particular type of music, as we all do, but at certain points in time in our life, that changes. I was a top 10 or top 100 guy for a long time, and then I started taking interest in blues and jazz, and that was based on my own desire, reaching out, hearing something, and doing that myself. I find now when you say, I like this kind of music, that's all you hear is that kind of music, and there's no chance for you to actually explore or hear something that you go, wow, I've never heard anything like that. I really like that, and then proceed down that path. One of the things I liked most about your book, Tom, was the history you provided around the songs, the composers, the artists who made them hits. You created that context for the listener to really appreciate the song. There are certain songs that you might hear that you think, well, I don't really like that song. That's not a great song. But once you understand the context in which that song was written, what was going on in the world at that time, what message the musician was trying to convey, well, then you take on a new level of appreciation for the song. And I really love that. Do you think this on-demand, algorithm-directed listening experience is robbing people and society of an important part of music history?
Totally concur. I really don't know what has been set aside or has been diarized about some of the stuff from the 90s and 2000s, especially after social media really took off, to find that stuff online bothers me a bit. And then also we have to understand too, there's just so much today. The world's larger, and not that there's not a lot of good stuff out there. There is, but there's just so much stuff. Again, only 24 hours in a day. And that's one of the challenges. And that's why people often say, I like the music I grew up with, because it is back, and I say this in quotes, simpler times, but it's something that they're able to get ahead around, especially older folks.
Yeah. Well, I certainly find the same thing with my listening as well, although I do reach out to listen to new music, but it is harder, and it usually has to come through somebody recommending something versus just going out and searching. Occasionally, I still listen to the radio, but mostly when I'm in the car, so I don't really get a chance to explore it the same way. But I'm quite happy to see that albums have made a comeback over the last number of years and that people are out there buying records again. And I know I've gone out and bought some albums. I just bought a new stereo and a turntable. I haven't owned a turntable in probably 20 years. It's a chance for me to go back into that period of self-exploration of music again.
Every Friday night I have a ritual. I pull out an album from the past. It could be country, it can be music, Broadway shows, it could be, and we play it. We play it both sides, and that's great. You know, it's just, and you reflect back and you sit back. See, the beautiful thing about music is that, as opposed to, say, watching video on television, with video and that, you're leaning in and you're focused, it's there. With music, you're leaning back. Where the theater of the mind takes you is whatever place you want to go to.
Right.
And that's very key. And that's why I find it very relaxing as well, no matter what genre I'm playing.
Right. And very few people listen to the full record. They listen to songs and compilation playlists and that kind of thing. But very few people actually sit down, which is something you and I grew up with. But we would sit down and we'd buy a record and we would listen to the whole record. And a lot of the records were concept records. So all the songs came together to create a story of some kind, certainly in the progressive rock era in the 70s. But I think people are missing that. And that's one of the reasons actually I went out and bought a new stereo and bought a turntable, was so that I could slow it down a bit and do exactly what you just said and sit down in an evening and listen to a whole record and try to get the complete feel of what the band or the musicians were trying to create. What's the message being reinforced through all the songs on the record? What's the narrative thread that connects them all together? You can't just pull out one song. To truly appreciate a work of art and the intentionality of the artist, you need to listen to the whole record in its entirety. Tom, your book and your interviews date from the 40s through to the 70s generally. Do you listen to any new music that's coming out now?
I do. And often when I listen to it, sometimes I'll pick it up from the radio, but often it'll be a reference point. I'll give you two examples. One that I picked up from TV and the radio in the last few years was Adele. And I just loved their voice, and I did a lot of comparisons with Adele with people I grew up with. But I love this song, Rolling in the Deep. The first time I heard it, I said, this is going to be a winner. And will she be a one hit? When I was curious about her, because she was a bit different for the right time. But what I can see in her is her passion to perform. And so that she's made herself a little different. And so she's on my bucket list, if you will, to see. Now, in terms of a band, per se, again, referenced by a good friend of mine who keeps on top of music. And he says, Tom, I think you're going to like this. I don't know if you know, but in Toronto, there's been a big rockabilly revival. And there's a group called the Shook Boys. That's S-H-O-O-K, Boys. And one of their songs that comes to mind right away is Love Bandit Jones. And I watched them on YouTube, heard them. It took me right back to Billy Lee Riley and his Little Green Men, who did a song called Red Hot that right people may remember Aerosmith redoing. But hey, I like this sound. I love the energy. To a point that when I go back to Toronto, I'm going to go and see these guys perform. But is that really a stretch for me, or is that taking me back to my love for rockabilly?
You mentioned Adele, and Adele has an absolutely spectacular voice. I'm not surprised. But I also noticed, while we're speaking about female vocalists, I noticed that you tend to have a preference towards female musicians. Is that accurate?
It's true. There's some that were absolutely incredible. I mean, Darlene Love, her days with the Wall of Sound, Phil Spector, what she did with the groups of Blahs, and her versatility. And she just got one of those great voices. One of the champions for me in the late 50s was a gal named Arlene Smith, who was in a group called the Chantels. Mm-hmm. This is the Shirelles, who did a big song called Maybe. And her voice was enchanting. And then I hear other ones that should have been huge hits, but they had $1.37 to promote their records. And there's a gal named Bertha Tillman who did a song called You're My Angel, which is written up in the book. And what a phenomenal record. If it had come out in New York and with the right backing, would have been top 10. There's no doubt about it in my mind. But it's their voice, the distinctiveness of their voice, the purity of the sound. And they didn't need the backup music. They could have sang those songs a cappella and still would have been strong.
So for you then, what constitutes a great song?
I feel like I'm on American Bandstand now. I like the beat and you can dance to it. I'd certainly be one of my responses. I think one of the big things in writing a song is having a really good catch phrase or riff in it that people hum along, or they'll sing that one line and that sticks with you, because that takes the momentum of the song down the line. And that has worked in so many records. You'll hear run phrase and you know what the song is right away. I'll go way back in one of the songs out of Beach Music out of the Myrtle Beach area down the Carolinas was a song called 60 Minute Man. As soon as you hear somebody say 60 Minute Man, people know what you're talking about if you're a fan of that music. But it had that riff in that's repeated often in the song. So that's one of the big hooks in a lot of the music that came out back then.
Yeah, and you make a great point. We remember the chorus. We don't often remember all the lyrics to the song, but I agree with you. It's and as a sort of a amateur musician, that's the part that I find most difficult about songwriting. I can write the song, that's not a problem, but it's coming up with that memorable chorus that will stick in people's minds. People can remember songs, they can sing usually one or two lines, and it's usually the chorus. So I agree with you. A memorable chorus is a key component of a great song. So if you were stranded on a desert island and you had five songs that you could have with you on that island, what would they be?
Yeah, well, obviously it was just eliminating compilation discs. That's probably I made a list of my top 100, believe it or not, back in 1976. And I actually reviewed that the other day and took a look at, you know, has that changed too much? A few of them did, but there was five in there that, boy, I'd love to have them with me. And they were, first and foremost, was Story of My Life by Marty Robbins, which I write about in the book. And that was Hal David and Burt Bacharach's first big chart buster. Interesting, it was a country crossover record. Then I have another one from the Beach Music era, from the Carolinas area, that ended up being one of their unofficial anthems. And it's called It Will Stand by a group called The Showmen. Their lead singer is a guy named Norm Johnson. He was known as General Norman Johnson. And he ended up being the lead singer on the Invictus label, and with the chairman of the board, Give Me Just a Little More Time. But this is him singing lead in 1961. It's a phenomenal record, and it talks about how rock and roll will stand. The third one is still one of my favorite groups. They had the pleasure of seeing them live in 1973 in Toronto. To me, it epitomizes what street corner harmony, or often the phrase doo-wop, means. And it's I Wonder Why by Dion and the Belmonts. Mm-hmm. That was their first breakout record, phenomenal record. And then another song, which is really a journey in how it got there, but I just love her energy. Seeing her perform it live was I Love Rock and Roll by Joan Jett and the Blackhearts. Love her version from 82, went to number one, and her story is also in my book. And last but not least was someone we talked about, and that was the song Maybe by Arlene Smith and the Chantels.
Mm, all great choices. And I did listen to them as I went through the book. So before we leave and move on to discuss the book, I want to get your perspective on whether you think we're going to see a renaissance in music or proliferation of new music post-COVID. Because, of course, a lot of musicians, and many we've interviewed on the show, haven't been out playing live. They've been in the studio, and they've been recording, and they've been writing. And as happened in the 60s, the late 60s, the political climate had a huge influence on the production of what I would consider quite meaningful music that reflected people's feeling at the time. They were under stress as a result of the Vietnam War and a variety of other things. And it produced a lot of great music. Are we going to see the same thing post-COVID?
Well, I think there is a renaissance in music during COVID because people are at home and they escape to music. So I think that's one thing. Mm. And that, I think, has been proven the timeliness of the book and the reaction I've had to it. The other thing I see is, hey, a lot of these artists were driven to perform and they love performing. A lot of people love seeing performers. And so I see big attendances coming down the line for big shows, and I see concerts come of age again, big time. And it could be ones looking back at groups, or it could be current artists today who have been popular, but now they've got a chance to get out and tour. Because what's changed in the music business now, the money's in touring. You use the records to promote you so you can get out and tour.
Right.
Back in the day, you made money from your records and you got out and tour to sell your records. So I really think concerts are going to go full swing again.
Yeah, well, I certainly hope so. It's one of the things that I miss most during this period is not being able to see live music. I have managed, when there's been some windows opened in the protocols around COVID, to sneak out and see a couple of shows, but not many. And I used to go out all the time to see shows. I think the last big show I saw was the Crossroads concert, Clapton's sponsored event in Dallas, Texas. And that was just pre-COVID. So I was very fortunate to be able to get tickets for that, of course, and get out to see that. 2.5 days of solid music kind of carried me through the periods of COVID. But I do miss that, and I certainly hope you're right. Well, let's move on to talking about the book. So this is obviously a passion project for you. How did it all begin?
Well, I guess it goes back to 1986 and my desire to see the stories behind some of these records are, you know, pretty phenomenal. So I thought, you know, maybe there's something there. And I guess I got spurred by the late, great Paul Harvey, who used to have a great syndicated show out of Chicago. And his one particular feature was the rest of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And he would begin very interesting cadence. He would capture your attention and he would go through setting the table, if you will, for his story and for a surprise indie. He would set the table, they'd have a commercial break, and then he would finish off with the rest of the story. They were fascinating. I found they were captivating. A lot of them biographically driven about famous people like Abe Lincoln, for example. So I'm going, well, think about this. You're driving to work in the morning or you're driving home and somebody starts talking about a record or an artist and you're trying to figure out who he's talked about. They get to shove in a little commercial. Perfect. Then you come at the end, you finish with the rest of the story, but even it's stronger because then you can finish off with the record.
Right.
A little piece every day people would look into. So that's what sort of drove me. And I went, geez, if I could create these 5-minute pieces, record included, and that wouldn't that be a neat thing? And so I went out in Vancouver, found a local DJ who really liked my concept, and so we did a demo of them. I did 5 of them, and they thought they were great. And then I bounced it off one of the guys at KTEL who did the production of all their albums that I post-produced here in Vancouver, and his comment was, there's not enough of them. These are great. I really like what you're doing. So that pushed me more. I said, I think I'm onto something there. But then I had the wind taken out of my sails when I went to Nashville and with a close compatriot down there who did all the TV commercials for radio stations. And he shared his stuff with the expertise of his staff, what I had written, and with some of the people. And what I got back was, hey, nobody wants sound bites. That's what they call them. Nobody wants sound bites today. They want our programming, like Dick Barkley type shows or Casey Kasem's Top 40, that type of thing. So I just shelved it for 7 years.
This concludes this week's episode of For What It's Worth, part 1 of Music Man, with my guest, author, and music fan, Tom Locke. Tom has kindly agreed to provide you, our listeners, with a limited number of signed copies of his book for a special price. We'll announce when the book is available for purchase and provide links on our show blog and in our show notes. We have a number of shout-outs this week. The first go to John DeVries and Ben Hunter for correctly guessing the name of the song and artist from last week's rock and roll trivia question. A moment in time from Tom's new book called Baby Come Back, featuring artist Eddie Grant. Their names will be placed in a draw to win a signed copy of Moments in Time, and we're going to continue with the trivia in the next episode of The Space in Between, so make sure you tune into the show for the clues. We also have another shout-out we want to make to Carlos Santana. Thanks to my friend Denise Ross, I was able to go and see Santana last week, and what a show. 74 years of age, and he hasn't lost a beat. I particularly liked his message of oneness, of living in the moment, of experiencing the show collectively as a group, and I think he was successful in making us do just that. It was also a real treat to see Cindy Blackman Santana on drums. Cindy was featured in the recent documentary Count Me In, and if you haven't seen that film, you gotta check it out. Cindy is a monster drummer. One of our chief goals at For What It's Worth podcast is to promote culture, change, and creativity through the work of our many guests. We also want to provide you, our listeners, with some cool opportunities to experience artists and their work outside the show. On that note, we have a couple of up-and-coming events featuring Blair Packham, one of the guests on our Pass the Jam series that we want to get on your radar. Have you ever tried to write a song but got stuck along the way? Blair and Company can help. They'll help you finish your songs with fresh perspectives and new ideas. The producers of Canada's premier songwriting workshop present the Song Studio Writers Room, a deep dive into rewriting. This event will be held online via Zoom all day Saturday, April 9th, and from 11 to 2 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, Sunday, April the 10th. This deep dive features the great songwriter, musician, and performer Michelle Willis. Michelle has performed with the likes of David Crosby, Becca Stevens, Iggy Pop and the Stooges, and the Zac Brown Band. She will be joined by songwriter mentors Blair Packham and Alistair Bradley. It's not a webinar, and it's not pre-recorded. It all happens real time, with one-on-one interaction with your mentors. Check it out at songstudio.ca. And if you can't make it to this one, there's more on the way, and we'll make sure you hear about it here first. Also, Blair Packham and the Impossible Dream continue their Toronto residency at Sauce on the Danforth, 1376 Danforth Avenue, every Wednesday night from 7 to 9 p.m. And even though it's called a residency, Blair, Jim Nielsen, and Andy Humphrey don't actually live at Sauce, although they probably could. The ambiance is a cross between a 19th century opium den and a Victorian brothel, and the fellows feel very much at home there. Come and enjoy their soaring and sweet harmonies along with Blair's provocative banter. The Impossible Dream and their songs could make you cry, laugh, or, hopefully, buy another round. Come and check them out. You can find out more information about both events on our show blog by joining our For What It's Worth series Facebook page, or in the show notes from this week's episode. I'm planning on attending this event in the near future, so if you see a guy sitting there with a weird microphone, come and say hi. For What It's Worth. Welcome to our